Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham. It's June 8th. This week, we'll hear about the crisis in Pakistan's Swat Valley and about how the Taliban's influence affects life in Lahore.
The Taliban cannot take over the rest of Pakistan. They can and have created a widespread security crisis in the rest of Pakistan.
We'll also hear about the sudden change in the Obama administration's policy on Guantanamo.
It undermines U.S. national security to keep Guantanamo open, and this was recognized across the board over the last few years, and suddenly we've had this major shift.
In Pakistan, fighting between government troops and the Taliban has forced nearly 3 million people to flee their homes in the country's northwestern Swat Valley. Pakistani government troops took control of Swat last month. I recently spoke with Human Rights Watch senior researcher Ali Dayan Hassan. He spent a week camping in the mountain passes of Pakistan and talking to people who were displaced by the conflict.
This is the largest displacement of a civilian population in the areas constituting Pakistan since the partition of India in 1947. And that, incidentally, was the largest movement of people in recorded history. So that should give you some conception of how massive this is. 3 million people have been made homeless. The world, international relief agencies, governments are trained and equipped in as far as they are to cater to IDP crises or refugee crises that deal with people in camps. Here we have a situation where the vast majority of these IDPs are in fact not in camps at all. Perhaps 10% of them are in camps. Mostly they are in the homes of other people. What this means essentially is that you face unique challenges providing relief to these people, whether it is in the form of food relief or other goods. Distribution is a huge big problem. And all the issues, health issues, for example, that would be restricted to camps, spread into the community. My impression, spending that time in that area, and of course I've been to that area under relatively normal circumstances as well, is that the area is under tremendous political, economic, and cultural strain. Things have been stretched to breaking point. And if they are allowed to break down, we could witness large-scale political mayhem in the region, which will be much greater than the war being fought in Swat and the district of Dir.
Well, let's go back and just, if you can explain, what is or was the war being fought in Swat? I know the Taliban had effectively taking control of Swat, and then a few weeks ago, the Pakistani government launched an offensive. Is that correct? And that's what caused this massive movement of people.
Well, essentially, you've described it correctly. That is what happened, except that there is a history to it. And the history to it is that this is actually the fourth offensive in Swat. Certainly, it is the biggest offensive in Swat, and it is the one that has displaced the greatest number of people. But this is the fourth time that the Pakistani military has engaged in hostilities with Taliban militants or militants that espouse religious extremist ideologies. Each time, the Taliban have returned strengthened. That has actually been the history of the area. So the people who are leaving have little faith in the ability of the state not just to defeat the Taliban, which is in all likelihood going to happen, or is happening, but to in fact hold the territory successfully and be able to ensure that the Taliban remain out of the areas. So when you talk to people, their fear of the Taliban is a real and live fear. It is not something that is in the past. Their resentment against the Pakistani military is equally real because you have to understand how these people view the Taliban. They view the Taliban as essentially creations of and proteges of the Pakistani military. They view what is happening in the region as part of a great game involving the United States, Pakistan, and other regional powers. And they view themselves as the pawns in this game, the great dispensable. And consequently, they are not very sure whether, in fact, they'll be returning to being ruled by the Taliban, whether the army means business this time, whether it can actually enforce the business, that even if it does mean it. And the fact is that they had learned to live under the Taliban. The brutality of the Taliban was problematic and painful for these people, but it was not what actually dispossessed them and made them lose their homes. They have lost their homes because the army has decided to fight the Taliban.
And which, under great international pressure, with support from the U.S. government, this is something that the U.S. certainly has been pushing for a long time, yes?
Absolutely. The U.S. has been pushing for the Pakistan army to take on the Taliban. And consequently, the resentment that you find is not just against the Pakistani military or the Pakistani state. It is equally against the U.S. And the view is that the Pakistani military and the Pakistani state are creatures of the U.S. So that is how essentially it works. Now, in terms of what is being done, these are people who feel very abandoned. They feel that the state has failed them. They don't trust their army, and they also, feel that the state is responsible for dispossessing them. The political parties that they elected a little over a year ago to essentially bring the peace to the region have presided over this grand displacement. So they appear to be running out of options within the framework of the Pakistani state. Now, when that happens, and unless the international community moves in rapidly to give them redress and deal with the situation in a meaningful and substantive manner, the real danger is, and the fear is, that actually these 5 or 6 million people who comprise most of the Pashtun areas of the Northwest Frontier Province.
This is on the border with Afghanistan.
On the border with Afghanistan. They may actually decide that their political well-being lies in aligning themselves with the Taliban, because through a process of elimination, they've got to the point where there is nobody else left to rely on. Now, that is something that would have very grave implications both for regional and international security, and above all for the human rights of these very people. And it is in the collective interest of the world, therefore, to prevent this happening.
There was a concern when Pakistan launched this operation into the Swat Valley that that there would be human rights abuses, that people would be rounded up and there would be mass arrests. What is your sense? I know you weren't able to get in there, but what is your sense from talking to refugees or displaced people?
On the face of it, it appears, and I say this with many qualifiers added, that the Pakistan army has been more careful in this operation than it is traditionally known to be. It is because, precisely for the reasons that I've outlined, they realize that this is a political tinderbox, that the situation can spiral out of control, and if 6 million people become actively angry as opposed to passive and long-suffering and accepting, it is a situation that even the Pakistan army may find itself unable to control. So consequently, I mean, and there have been public indications of the army's awareness of this. In the last 3 or 4 weeks, we issued several statements pointing out civilian casualties as we got these reports. And also this business of the humanitarian crisis. And the Pakistani military, when faced with a question by a journalist, apologized for civilian casualties. Now, and I emphasize this is the first time in living memory that the Pakistani military has apologized for anything.
And in terms of the success of this military operation in Swat, was the Taliban defeated there? Is there, in fact, a success there?
Effectively, what had happened was that the Taliban had taken over the major population centers in the Swat Valley, and the military and the state had effectively retreated to the hills. Now, at this moment, what we are seeing is a reversal of that situation, where the military and the state have reestablished their presence in what are known to be the major population centers. They're relatively empty right now, but you know, the major towns have been taken over. And the Taliban fighters have retreated to the hills. The real battle begins now, which is the military and the Pakistani state's capacity to hold this territory and to actually deal with the militants who are now holed up in the hills and hiding and fighting from there. And essentially, this is their moment of reckoning. Will they be able to hold these towns? Will they be able to impose law and order? Will they be able to prevent Pakistani citizens living in Swat from being terrorized by the Taliban and from being subjected to the summary justice of the Taliban, which includes beheadings and floggings and vigilante killings? So, in a sense, the battle has begun now. The major part of the military offensive appears to be winding down, but the real battle to hold Swat and to prove that the state means business begins now.
Ali Dayan Hassan says Pakistan is facing an existential crisis. He says the country is not on the brink of a Taliban takeover, but he does feel the effects of the radical group beyond the Swat Valley, even when he's home in Lahore.
There is a difference between a Taliban takeover and the knock-on effects of Talibanization, and I think we need to differentiate between the two. While the Taliban cannot take over the rest of Pakistan, they can and have created a widespread security crisis in the rest of Pakistan. There is a militant fault line that runs throughout Pakistan. The Pakistani military and the Pakistani state has nurtured and supported extremist militants across the country. These are people in sympathy with the Taliban. They may not be able to take over the provinces of Punjab and Sindh or the city of Lahore or the city of Karachi, but they can cause havoc in these cities. They can engage in suicide bombings, as they have, and engage in acts of terrorism. What that does is as follows. It creates a lot of fear in society. I went to collect her from school one day, and because there was a bombing in the city, and basically, whenever that happens, the protocol is you go and you get your children out of school early, as soon as possible, essentially. And I went there, and she said, and she saw me, and she said, "Oh, you're here early today." And I was about to, you know, come up with some kind of story or the other. And she looked at me, and she's 6 years old, and she laughed, and she said, "Oh, I know, the suicide bomber has suicided." And I laughed, and I just thought, how sad, how tragic that I didn't know about bombs at the age of six. They weren't part of my, you know, mental architecture at all. And you know, this loss of innocence is a very painful thing to witness, but it's happening, and there is, so far, it's loss of innocence. We have to prevent it from turning into brutalization, because when you brutalize societies, they collapse.
And so, how do we do that? What needs to happen?
We do that by dealing with this situation and by dealing with the situation in a way that neutralizes the Taliban. You neutralize the Taliban by changing the circumstance of people, by giving them a better life, by ensuring that they don't have any reason to seek buy-in into what the Taliban have to offer, which is pretty nihilistic in any case, and you have to really be in a very bad place to seek buy-in into what they have to offer. Often it is a function of having no option but to seek buy-in into it, as has happened to the people of Swat. The Pakistani state has to become functional. The world, particularly the United States, has to help the Pakistani state become functional and deliver to its own people. And everyone has to conspire to make this a successful exercise. The knock-on effect of Talibanization doesn't just happen in the city of Lahore. It will happen, however removed, in New York City as well. We have to guard both Lahore and New York City from that sort of impact, and we do it by dealing with it at the source, by empowering people, by giving them rights, and by giving them a better life.
That was Ali Dayan Hassan, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. I've been away for a couple of weeks. Before I left, it looked like President Obama was well on his way to closing Guantanamo. But now that's all changed. Stacey Sullivan is counterterrorism advisor at Human Rights Watch.
If you were to look at the situation in this country in April, there was consensus that Guantanamo needed to be closed. Former President Bush said it needed to be closed. The Defense Secretary Gates said it needed to be closed. Public opinion was widely in favor of closing Guantanamo. You look at what's happened since then, largely as a result of some Republican Congress members who have engaged in what I would classify as just overt fear-mongering. They've talked about how we would have to release Guantanamo terrorists onto U.S. soil in any kind of effort to close Guantanamo down, which is utter nonsense. They've talked about terror suspects going into U.S. prisons and indoctrinating the existing prison population, radicalizing them and turning them into terrorist suspects. And as a result of that, we've seen legislation pending to keep Guantanamo open. We have legislation in the works to establish a regime of detention, indefinite detention without charge in the United States. We have seen amendments to authorization bills to block the resettlement of any Guantanamo detainees into the United States. We've seen specific legislation to stop the Uyghurs, who are innocent, who the United States has never even accused of doing anything and has acknowledged that them being in Guantanamo was a mistake. We've seen legislation to block them from coming to the U.S. Congress voted 90-6 to block funding for President Obama to close Guantanamo. We've seen a really radical shift in this country that is not only morally reprehensible, but it undermines U.S. national security to keep Guantanamo open. And this was recognized across the board, you know, over the last few years. And suddenly, we've had this major shift.
And what's caused the shift? How did this happen so quickly?
I think under pressure from the military and intelligence agencies and Republicans who feel like they're getting traction on this issue by scaring the American public, we've seen an absolute backing down from what President Obama had promised on his second day in office.
Sullivan says if the U.S. doesn't agree to resettle some of the detainees, Europe isn't going to accept any of them. She says this means that President Obama won't be able to meet his pledge to close Guantanamo by next January. And that's Rights Watch for this week. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. For more about us, including audio, video, and multimedia features, please visit hrw.org. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham.